Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. President Trump references fake news all the time, but he's not talking about the real fakes, that is, videos produced using artificial intelligence to make a person appear to be saying something, well, fake. Brooke Borrell of Popular Science has covered this issue. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
How does this software work?
How does the software work? That's a good question, and the answer kind of depends on what specific software we're talking about. Some of the videos that we've seen so far, and I want to stress that mostly this tech has been used sort of to make jokey fake videos, like swapping actors' faces into movies they never appeared in and that sort of stuff. We haven't really seen a big political, you know, campaign to use these in that sort of sense, but the app that we have seen quite a bit of that is available for people to use and download is called Fake App. And it basically works by crunching lots and lots of images and videos of people's faces. So this is why we mostly see examples from movie stars or from politicians, where there are a lot of examples of their faces and videos and photos out on the internet. And they sort of crunch all of these together to blend a face of one person into an existing video and blend it in to make it look as though their mouth is moving and their eyes are moving and such in that original video, but it's a face that did not appear in there. They don't look entirely real, though. There are some sort of blurred aspects between the skin. You can tell it's not necessarily real, but it points to the direction we might be going in.
It's not real yet.
Right.
What does artificial intelligence have to do with this?
Sure. So artificial intelligence is an umbrella term that can mean any sort of attempt to imitate intelligence, like human intelligence or even animal intelligence. And when you hear it these days, it's often used to describe a subset of AI, which is machine learning. And this is really mostly a statistical model where the scientists, researchers, they're feeding a lot of data into an algorithm, into a computer program that they've designed. These days, these usually are several layers of simple mathematic formulas that are an attempt to mimic the way the brain, the neural circuits in a brain. So they're not exactly like that, but that's the idea. And they feed these algorithms lots and lots of, say, images of faces, for example, and teach them to recognize this is a human face. And then in some cases, they have been able to do that and teach these algorithms to not only recognize a human face, but make a new human face that looks like it's real, but doesn't actually exist out there in the world. It's just looked at a bunch of examples of human faces and says, well, now I can make a human face, based statistically on what it knows from these hundreds or thousands of examples.
What are the ethics of all of this? Are there any?
Are there any ethics of all this? I mean, look, as with many areas of scientific research, a lot of this stuff is happening, not the fake app that I described, but a lot of sort of higher tech versions of this. This is happening in computer labs with the intent to use this for movies and that sort of thing, for editing, not with the intention to have it used for misinformation and disinformation campaigns. So when research is in that basic stage in the lab, most researchers aren't necessarily working with ethicists or thinking about all the different ways that technology might land in the real world. They're thinking about trying to solve a problem. So a lot of this research at this stage is in that step. But I do think, and a lot in the reporting I've done and in talking to many, many experts, I do think that there is a move towards wanting to talk more about how this kind of technology could land in the wrong hands. But you could say that about any technology. Mm-hmm. Any technology has a capability to be used for both positive or negative things.
But so much of the conversation, the cultural conversation these days, is about what's real and what's not real. I mean, we're already starting to talk about that, and it's really only the very, very early advent of this.
Yeah, that's true.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Brooke Borrell of Popular Science about the issue of using AI or artificial intelligence to mimic human personas. And also, is sound involved in this, Brooke?
There are some companies that are using machine learning to create new audio clips that sound like a person, make it basically makes it sound like the person has never said that makes them say something they've never said. These sound very robotic, though. They don't sound completely real. Mm-hmm. You can imagine maybe using them in a case where you have a bad cell connection, or there are probably ways in which you could use these to trick someone. But if you listen to them in a clear line, they don't sound real. But it is sort of pointing in that direction where we could eventually have audio that does sound like someone that, you know, is making them say something they never said.
Are these things, you said that these programs were developed to solve a problem, chiefly in the entertainment world with video and, to help in the editing process. So you don't have to reshoot a scene, I would imagine. You can just tweak it.
Yeah.
But there are people out there in your article, you write about people who are driving the conversation around these advancements and what they mean to, the world writ large.
Yeah, I, as with any technology, it's going to be, you can never really predict how the public might use a particular technology. Mm-hmm. I think that this technology has been advancing for more than a decade at this point, and it is sort of reaching the point where it is going to be more democratized and easier for the general public to use, with a bunch of caveats there. And it happens to be landing in an interesting political moment. So it's sort of the whirlwind of all of these things happening at once that has us focusing on the potential bad uses for this tech.
When was this kind of computer-generated imagery first being used?
Well, in the beginning, it was for movies. It was for creating scenes of things that never existed. You can imagine early science fiction movies. You can imagine Forrest Gump, for example, where we have Forrest Gump shaking hands with President Kennedy.
Oh, that's right.
These sorts of cases where they're trying to either recreate something from history or change something from history for entertainment or make scenes of something that never happened.
And now the question is that it's advanced so much that it can fool people.
With some caveats. So, yes. But there are still, the technology isn't to the point that it always will be able to generate, say, an entire scene that is perfectly seamless, that it won't be noticeable that there are, that it's fake. That you can often see artifacts around the edges of a face, for example, that's been put into a different scene. The research that's coming out of the lab can make very specific scenes. They can make faces looking in a very particular sort of direction, like a portrait style direction, but it isn't necessarily to the point where we can create entire fake scenes. But that is the direction that this might possibly go in the future.
What about deep video? What is that?
Deep video is research that came earlier this year in the spring from a group at the Max Planck Institute in Germany. And this also uses a form of the AI that we're talking about, where you can have a video of one person and then you can have another person sort of controlling the face, the expressions and face of the person in that video, even though that video was already shot. Again, with some caveats, they've only done that, at least as far as I know, in portrait mode. If the person moves their face too much, there are blurs around the edges and drop pixels and that sort of thing. So it's not perfect, but it is interesting. And, the implications for that kind of technology are concerning when we're talking about disinformation.
Is there something different about video that affects us emotionally? I mean, are they looking at that?
Well, there is a small but growing body of scientific research on fake news more broadly. Most of it has focused on written fake news. And
right.
I don't necessarily like the term fake news, but we do use it. And when I use it, I'm meaning, misinformation or disinformation that's intentionally trying to mislead people, but looks as though it's a real news article. It's, trying to mimic actual real news, but it contains disinformation.
Mm-hmm.
So there hasn't been a lot of research even on that type of misinformation and disinformation, and this new stuff with audio and video is so new that we really don't have a lot of research to indicate what will happen. There is some research in other areas of psychology that indicates that maybe video might have more of an emotional response than written word, but they do need to do a lot more research to sort of tease out what that means.
You wrote that worrying about this might be worse than the videos themselves.
Yeah, so even us talking about this, there are probably listeners thinking, oh my gosh, like this sounds really frightening, and it could sort of lead to people not wanting to believe or being skeptical of everything they see that's out there. I think it's important for us to talk about this technology and also talk about its limitations and talk about the fact that we still need to have critical thinking and we still need to trust some media, right? We still need to be able to figure out what is real and what is not. And there's a lot of concern that eventually people will start not trusting anything, or that you can imagine, say, a politician or someone else having a real video out there showing them doing some sort of misdeed, and then them saying, oh, well, it was fake. It was one of these artificial intelligence, you know, generated mm-hmm. videos. And that is a concern as well. So I think in general, we should be aware of this technology, but let's not let it sort of make us not trust anything, because that's also not a good place to be.
Brooke Borrell, thank you for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, sure.
Brooke Borrell is works for Popular Scientist. She's an editor there, and she has covered the issue of AI and film and fake news or fake film. So more Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Virtual reality is usually thought of in terms of gaming for a lot of people. A Columbus-based company is looking at how it can be used in education. Joining us is founder and CEO of Immersive, Will Burris. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
How did it come to you to start applying VR to educational, for education?
You know, that's a good question. I actually, I originally dove into VR thinking that I could build short burst arcade games.
I wanted to do
modern twist on classic arcade games. And then I started to notice as I was indulging into the content that it was highly, highly empathetic, right? Like every time I went into a world, the two things I thought was, how am I going to die and who's standing behind me?
Uh-huh.
You know? So I started to notice very quickly that I was really empathizing with the people that were in there. And then I have an autistic grandson. I found an autism simulator in virtual reality, and I was able to see the world through his eyes.
I think I've heard about that, right?
Yeah, it was powerful. So, you know, I all of a sudden had a frame of reference for how to raise him, kind of how to get with my daughter and say, listen, this is what we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that really changed the course of it. I started to realize that, you know, I like to draw a distinction between an entertainment VR and a cognitive VR. Mm-hmm. So we started to dive down that lane. And in the process of just digging and learning and doing projects, it started to really become real for me that learning was going to be severely impacted by this technology. It's just so empathetic, you know. The idea of learning by doing mm-hmm. Is exponentially greater than watching a video or reading a PowerPoint or sitting in a lecture. So it just felt like the natural evolution of this concept, you know, similar to how technology is disintermediating everything else, you know, from services like, you know, email or video. Now it seems to be disintermediating industries, you know, and I think the conceptual things are going to be next, you know, so behavior, recall, learning, things like that.
Give me an example of how you're working to use it for educational purposes at Immersive.
So we have been building out simulations. We're really trying to focus on scenario-based learning. For example, we built a social work training simulator where we got with a subject matter expert and we modeled what it's like to have a home visit, right? The goal was really I wanted to help people to become more empathetic to the families that they're dealing with when they're coming out of these schools. Mm-hmm. And then also to have a better idea how to deal, you know, how to escalate, de-escalate if the wheels fall off, right? So we literally built an apartment, and we put a mother and her son in there, and you have a script and an iPad, and you are the caseworker, and you have to actually navigate this conversation with the mom. If you mess up, she gets mad and she stomps out the apartment, and then you have to, you know, she has to come back in and you have to do it again. So pretty proud of that one. We did another one where we modeled an epileptic seizure, actually. That one is more of a, not so much of a scenario as it is more of an experiential moment. What we wanted to do
was... What does that feel like? How do you do that with VR? I just think of VR mostly in terms of visuals and spatial movement, but beyond that...
You know, that's it's funny you say it that way. That's what we experience, right? You add in a little bit of an audio cue to it. Now, we have a couple other senses that aren't represented, but that is largely the makeup of our reality, right? So what we do is we kind of reverse engineer that. So, you know, when we started to think about a seizure, we had a lot of families that were in with kids that were having seizures. You know, we were trying to gather some feedback, watched a ton of video of people doing it. And what we realized is, you know, there's certain elements that are similar. So we modeled a spin, for example, and we had to get the rotation just right to get your brain to lose balance effectively. We have what I call the Hollywood fall, right, where you, in the midst of losing this balance, you kind of fall to the side and you thud on the ground and you hear, and then we added audio elements. So you hear your teeth grinding, you hear your heart pumping, you see the bloodshot going through your eyes. It was, you know, just a kind of a, we go symptom by symptom and just try to model that. We're doing the same thing for detoxing off of opioids right now. It's a fascinating way to think about a technology. You know what I mean? But
I mean, when a lot of people, if we say education, they're thinking something classroom.
The right now classrooms seem to be, you know, gripping the idea that I can put you wherever you want to be. So, you know, you can do a tour of Egypt, or I've been on a Titanic, for example, or Stonehenge, things of that nature. I think that's really just the beginning, though. I think where it's really going to take root is in that interpersonal dynamic. Now, we still have to get better about modeling that, emulating that, and understanding how we're impacting you when we're in these experiences. But I think that's where it's going to eventually land.
How much interest is there in this? I know you're working with OSU, right?
Mm-hmm. What? Yeah. You know, there's, I'll tell you, we've been in business a little over a year now, and it used to be this really long sales cycle. We had to bring people in. We put them on this plank, basically 20 stories high. It's the best way to get you to really understand.
I won't jump either, by the way.
I would love to have you try this thing. It's incredible. But I'll tell you, within the last 6 months or so, I think it's people are really starting to get it. So it started to escalate fairly quickly. We started off in athletics. That was a one of the first places has really landed. We built a we worked with the hockey team, hockey coaches in athletics department, to build a kind of an experience of what it's like on the day of the game to help with recruiting. So we literally captured some stills first on the ice, and then, you know, going into the locker room, and you hear the taping of the sticks and the buildup, and then you end up in the locker room, and the coach is giving his thing. Then we literally walk you out, and all the players kind of dap you up as you're walking out, and you end up on the ice with the explosions and the players going around you. It was fun. It's a really, I'm really proud of that one.
I'm interested in the route you've gone with the experiencing somebody else's experience. And you talked about replicating a version of an experience of being autistic.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you know, there's a spectrum.
That's right.
How many iterations have you embraced at this point?
You know, I tend to look at it like this. At the end of the day, where I think that VR is going to be so impactful in our society is in simply creating awareness, right? Everybody has their own frame of reference, but it's not somebody else's frame of reference. So
actually, you'll be able to walk in somebody else's shoes.
Yes, very much so. Very much so. But we can't be we'll never be fully accurate with that walk. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So for me, I read a lot of feedback on the autism one that I did. And there was equal parts, you know, this is nothing like it and this is exactly like it. Mm-hmm. And I kind of expected as much. But for me, what hit me was it didn't matter. What mattered was I knew that the sensory processing of my grandson was way out of whack. And I felt that. You know what I mean? So as a result, I started to make my own assumptions, like I'm not going to yell. You know, now I understand why a food might taste. I don't know exactly what he's experiencing, mm-hmm. but I know that he's experiencing something. So mm-hmm. I'm going to be more aware of that. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, kind of one of the ways that I just attack it. I don't think we'll ever be able to fully capture it. But if I can just get you to somewhat understand, you know what I mean? We were working on a concept with the police department where I wanted to switch the roles, right, and have the have a member of the community sit and officiate the traffic stop, right? They have to walk up, you know, check the trunk, walk up and actually do the traffic stop uh-huh. as if they're the law enforcement officer. And then conversely, I wanted the law enforcement officer to be in the car.
I was going to say, that's what a lot of people are thinking.
Because at the end of the day, it will just change the conversation. And that's all we really need to do.
And what kind of feedback do you get from them?
They love it. They love it. It's you know, the big challenge for us, I don't think, is getting people to understand the power of the tech. It's just getting people to understand the power of the tech. But by that, I mean, you know, we have to get you in. You have to. This is one of those things we joke around in the office and we say we're giving you the red pill. Right.
Right. I've been thinking of Matrix a lot. Recently.
For the Matrix heads out there. But it is truly one of those things that I can't explain it to you. You know what I mean? Like, that's why we love the plank. I can't explain to you what it feels like when you start sweating.
Yeah, but I will not jump off that plank. That's what I keep telling people. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about how to use virtual reality in very serious ways to educate people. And my guest, Will Burris, founder and CEO of Immersive, is saying to let people not just learn about a place or a thing, but maybe learn about a feeling and how someone else is experiencing the world. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I would imagine, like so much technology, right now this is pretty expensive.
You know what's awesome is not so much anymore.
Okay,
so
I'm
seeing the price drop rapidly. So when I started, you know, I spent about $2,000 for the first good setup, right? That was about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I had this thesis that when, you know, you get the 6-degree experience, which is an experience where you can interact, you can grab things, you can walk around with no cords, for under $300.
Yeah, that's we just talked about that last week.
I think that's the tipping point. I think that's when there'll be no more cell phones, there'll be no more social media. Everybody will live in these worlds. So February, right? In February, a unit called the Oculus Go came out.
Yeah.
$199 at Best Buy. And it's actually better visual quality than the $2,000 unit that I got. Now, it's only 3 degrees of freedom, which means you can move your head around the experience, but you can't walk around. Mm-hmm. So we're halfway there. But I'm seeing a lot of people scooping those things up and getting into the world. And it's a great way to really understand how it works. So it was just announced by Oculus that in the spring, that unit, my dream unit, is coming out.
Right.
And I can't wait to see how that's going to impact. I think that's going to change everything. I really do.
What is better about virtual reality when it comes to, say, training a social worker to do a home visit than a real, with real people doing role playing?
The biggest thing is risk and repetition, right? So we don't have to risk you going into an environment that might be unsafe or, you know, creating some friction with a family that doesn't really feel like being in that petri dish, you know. Mm-hmm. We can put you into an environment and let you practice over and over.
You could have people doing role-playing those roles, but they wouldn't be really who they are.
So that's what's awesome about virtual reality is in about 5 minutes, you'll feel like they really are who they are. And at that point, your brain is reacting and responding in the exact same way as if they were real people. So here's something awesome. When we were building that experience, we had this problem. We called it the stand-up, sit-down problem, right? The big thing that we try to be aware of is immersion. We don't want to break immersion. We don't want you to realize that you're not in the virtual world. Now, one of the first things we learned is that as a caseworker, when you get in, you need to sit down, right? You can't stand up and try to lord over the family.
This is all about, nonverbal cues and that kind of a thing.
Absolutely,
right.
Right. Okay. So the question became, how well, you start off and you knock on the door, mom lets you in, now you're standing up. So how do you sit down? Because you're in a virtual environment, right? So I used to stand off to the side with a chair, and I would watch you on the monitor. And when you got to that stage, I would run up and then hit the back of your knees, and then you had to sit down. We can't scale that. So we brought this social work graduate in from Chicago, and I, had her over, and I'm like, okay, Grace, listen, here's the problem, right? We have this stand-up, sit-down issue. We can't figure out how to deal with this. She was sitting there in the room, just looking around while I was talking to her, and she says, Will, I don't really care about this stand-up, sit-down stuff. I'm trying to figure out why mom is so miserable over here right now. And it was like an epiphany, like, wow, I programmed that woman. You know what I mean? Like, we made her look like that. But she was completely empathetic to the fact that she was sitting there miserable, and within minutes was just completely engrossed with, like, how do I solve this problem? So I think it's the same thing. We just
So you're programming then the character, the mother, to not respond and not worry about whether you're standing or sitting.
Yeah. Okay. What we did is we decided to just make the entire experience focus on the sit down portion. So rather than having you knock on the door and come in, we just start you off in the experience sitting there with mom and son, and you navigate the dynamics, the relationship rather than.
And then the rest will come as the technology evolves.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, since we've done that, that was one of the first ones we did. They have sensors now that you can put on a chair so you can map the digital chair into the physical space. Yeah.
It is. It's really interesting the direction you've taken this. Are there others out there that are doing the same thing? There must be.
No, I'm just kidding. There's a couple that are starting to dig into it. I think the thing that is taking off right now in the training space is what we call an observational course, or a 360 video based course. So there's a company called Striver that just sold 17,000 Oculus Go's into Walmart. But largely that training is we film the environment and then we annotate that environment, and you have to pick out the things that are right or wrong. We haven't really found many that are moving down this notion of, like, role playing or interpersonal communication. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to see a little bit of rumbling, but still early. We made a conscious effort to find team members that were deep into psychology and stuff like that.
Okay. Yeah. Right. That was your background's technology, right?
Absolutely.
IT.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And you had to find people that could help you build these scenarios.
That's right. Yeah. I have I've done some work in this space before. I have another company that was heavy in developmental psychology. We came up with an algorithm that quantifies how people work. So I started to understand, in the form of a number, like a credit score, which is really cool.
Weird.
But that was a great kind of synthesis of these two worlds for me. So I kind of think like that now. But then I went and consciously found one of my partners, Alexis Yamakowski, is a sociology, psychology PhD. So we do a lot of thinking just about people and empathy and how to model that and how to interact with that, as kind of a core competency of immersive.
You're saying, right now then, the expanding this is only a function of the technology itself and how portable it becomes?
Yes, right. Absolutely. Yeah. And that unit really opened the door. I think, that made it so much easier to demo it, to show it off, to let people engage. People are less afraid of the portable units. I've had some meetings where I come in with the big rig and it takes me forever to get it set up, and people are kind of staring like that Seinfeld episode, like they don't want to touch that thing. But this one, we drop them on a table, people dive in, and they're really, really engaged. And I've had awesome feedback, that people remembered. You know what I mean? They knew, they experienced.
It's like
something.
An experience, not something you're watching in a movie or a film strip or, whatever it might be.
Absolutely. I could model this entire scenario right here and replay it over and over again.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would feel the same level of presence that I'm feeling here with you right now.
Huh.
Yeah. It's pretty powerful stuff.
What else are you thinking about?
I'm thinking a lot about learning because I am, I felt a sense of accountability, right? I watched social grow, and I watched my daughter, I have a 28-year-old daughter, deal with that. And I've watched how her world is so drastically different than my world. I see the rates of anxiety and depression and all of that good stuff. And I'm bothered by that.
Mm-hmm.
So, especially as a technologist, being in it as long as I've been in it. So, you know, going into VR, I started to notice immediately, you know, this is going to change things. It's going to desensitize in a different way. It's going to, you know, it's so empathetic, right? People are going to become addicted to it. So then I started to kind of extrapolate that. You know, one of the things that I'm intrigued with is this idea that this comes from my developmental side, that, you know, mastery, right, is what kind of builds that confidence that gets you to self-actualization. That comes through mastering a skill set, right? The problem is we're automating all of the skill sets right now. So, you know, for the younger generations,
we're automating it. So why do we have to learn it?
Exactly. But if we don't learn it, my fear is that then we won't have opportunities to kind of grow and mature and evolve.
And make it better.
Exactly. All that's just going to be ubiquitous. It'll just be accessible. So we have to think about that, right, with this younger generation, because we didn't think about that with Facebook. You know what I mean? And now we've got kids that are miserable, that are living behind these screens. So this is going to be 10 times more impactful. So I want to think about, you know, how do we get people to grow, right, when all the information of the world is just ubiquitously accessible?
And I'm also thinking about, you talk about taking tours places and going on tours with VR, and that seems fine, but there could be emotional tours as well, right?
Absolutely.
Experiencing not just what it's like to be on the Titanic, but maybe to be in the hold during when they were enslaving people and bringing them over in ships.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean,
there's a lot of experiences that we could learn more about.
Absolutely. Yeah. I just did one on Oculus called Falling in Love, actually.
Really?
And it was just, I think they were just trying to capture that. So it's like just a simple dialogue with different characters, you know, but the nuance of the dialogue, you know, is clever, the way that they put it together.
How much does AI come into play with all of this?
You know, I think those two are going to crash into each other and create some ultra creepiness, right? Like effectively, I could take AI and then I could render that. I could give that a visual experience that now I can interact with in a more intuitive way. So it's just a matter of time before we have avatars in virtual worlds. I have a thesis that we should keep all AI in a virtual world.
There's a movie. This is very Black Mirror in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
In the wrong hands, what could happen? What do you worry about?
You know, I worry about us kind of crippling ourselves, right? I worry about the addiction. I worry about the kind of desensitization. That's a big one, right? You know, there was a company that created a school shooting trainer.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Did you hear about that?
Yeah.
And they just put that thing out on the Steam store, almost like a video game.
Yes.
And I was really bothered by that because, you know, there's a lot of people that are going to download that aren't going to really be thinking about the impact of what they're doing. But they're subconsciously programming themselves that that's not a big deal, right? I mean, this is proven to rewire your brain. So I worry about that.
Remember that really old film, The Last Starfighter?
Oh, yeah.
They were training him to, you know, he didn't realize it, but he was being trained to do something. I guess
That's
Ender's
right.
Game is another example
That's another
of that.
Great example. Yeah.
Do you worry about that?
You know, I do and I don't, right? I'm equal parts accepting the reality of it and being somewhat opportunistic. I don't know that we can stop it. I just say that, you know, we have to be accountable. You know what I mean? Let's just go out. We know it's going to happen, but let's build things that are for the good as much as possible, as fast as possible.
And one more question, I got to let you go, but your daughter, the mother of your autistic grandson, has she tried it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a powerful moment. I called her immediately after I did that.
What'd she think?
I mean, it was emotional, right? I mean, you know, when you're she was 20, 21 years old when she had him. So she was just learning how to grow up, you know, and now she has a special needs child. Right. And the world is not built for single mothers with special needs children. Right. It's been a rough journey. But the hardest part, again, is just not knowing. Right. So, you know, we used to see him kind of staring at the wall and laughing. We could never figure out what that was. Now I know that things are moving. You know, he's seeing patterns moving on the wall. He's hearing things in different ways. And we talked a lot about that. And I immediately saw it with her. Her whole perspective changed. She was much more patient with them, you know, more engaged. It was just all you need sometimes is just a frame of reference. You know, we tend to kind of get into our shell and we think that our reality is everyone's reality.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's not at all. So.
Will Burris, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks
I really appreciate
me.
Your time.
Absolutely.
It's Will Burris. He's founder and CEO of Immersive, and they're talking about how to use virtual reality in an educational sense, and maybe not the way you're thinking, not a classroom sense, but to helping people empathize, to helping people understand how other people feel. We'll have more Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Microsoft and Google both announced game streaming services in the past week. Microsoft's Project X Cloud and Google's Project Steam Stream allow users to play their favorite video games wherever and whenever. Here to talk about these streaming services and other tech news is Android Central contributing editor Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
Don't make me say that, you know, 10 times really fast. So Microsoft streaming. Let's start with their newly announced game streaming Project X Cloud. What does it do? What do we know?
So Project X Cloud is a system where you sign up from either your phone or your iPad or you know, your Surface or something like that, and you go to play these games. And instead of installing the game on that thing, you're actually streaming the game, and it's being installed and played on a server maintained by Microsoft. So the way this has worked in the past is you pay a monthly fee, and you have access to these games as though they were installed on your own computer. This gives you the ability to play them anywhere, regardless of you know, what you're playing on. And Microsoft's big thing here is being able to take these games from your Xbox instead of a PC to your phone and to your tablet so that you can continue to play that same game that you'd be playing in the living room anywhere that you go, you know, with any kind of reasonable internet connection.
So I'm playing a game and I'm going to go on a trip and I can just bring it with me.
Right. Instead of you know, trying to unpack the Xbox and bring it with you and set it up in the car or something like that, you'd effectively be able to play it from your phone or your tablet or your computer.
Is it just a smartphones? Or are you talking about smartphone or tablet? Anything like
Microsoft
that.
Microsoft wants this to be able to run the same way on everything, but the important thing about the way xCloud is being sent to people is through your phone and your tablet, you have access to these kind of touch controls where you can simulate the Xbox controller on the actual glass and be able to play, whereas a lot of times you see you know, needing to connect an Xbox controller to another computer and have to set it up as though it were this kind of unique thing. To do that. And that's still an option. You are still able to use the controller that you're comfortable with because, you know, they're Bluetooth controllers that you can bring and kind of connect to anything. But having those controls on the screen means that you really can just kind of pick up anything and play.
Microsoft has access to about 3,000 games on Xbox One. That's a lot. I mean, are we talking about all those games or are they going to roll it out in some kind of recognizable semblance?
Yeah, the way we've seen Microsoft handle similar things in the past is to have kind of subscription services that will give you access to different tiers of games. So maybe, you know, $3 or $4 a month, you have access to one or two games that you can play, or $10 a month, they'll give you access to, you know, 200 or 300 games that you can play. And then, you know, a $20 tier that would give you access to everything. For example, they haven't actually given, you know, pricing for any of that stuff yet, but that would be the idea that I would see Microsoft going, and then probably have this ready to go at launch with some kind of really big title.
You know, we've talked about moving from the monitor, you know, your 52-inch screen at home to your cell phone, or your, I should say, your smartphone. to me, it seems like the experience. I am not interested in watching movies on my smartphone. Am I just old?
No, I think you're just not in places where you're kind of stuck and have a show that you want to catch up on.
Okay.
I very rarely go to watch, you know, shows on my phone or something like that, unless I'm, you know, watching a show that, you know, I watch, I think weirdly, one of the places that I watch TV more than anywhere right now is in my kitchen while I'm making dinner. So because of that, I will take those shows. I'm more likely to take those shows with me on an airplane or something like that, where I'm kind of stuck for a couple hours if I don't have a book to read or something. But if I start a show in front of the television, then I usually only watch it there. So maybe I'm the weird one.
Well, what about gaming, though? I mean, it just seems that the experience would be so diminished.
Yeah, it certainly could be. Having the smaller screen means that there's kind of less of that, world gazing, yeah, where you get to really kind of appreciate the stuff that's happening in the background. On the other hand, we're in a place where so many people are playing games that are online focused and less about the world and more about kind of local combat. So it could be that this just appeals to a different kind of player, someone who prefers, say, Horizon Zero Dawn or Fallout 76 or something like that, may prefer to only play in front of the television, but that's certainly not going to be everyone.
Google streaming, they're doing a technical test of this. What does that mean? What phase are we in with that?
So Google has a single game that you're able to play with its service that you can sign up as kind of a beta test between now and January. And there's a few limitations there. You're only playing the new Assassin's Creed Odyssey, but you don't have to have paid for the game. You basically get this copy of this game that you can play between now and January for free. And as you are playing it, you can play it on anything that has a full version of the Chrome browser. So it can be your most expensive computer that you sit in front of your desk, or it can be kind of a really portable laptop, or even, you know, the really inexpensive Windows slate like the Surface Go. So being able to kind of span that range, as long as you have access to the Chrome browser, it'll play on Mac, it'll play on Windows, it'll play in any of these places. And then, of course, Google's Chromebooks, being able to play there as well. And so it's limited to this one experience right now. Google's kind of testing this this very kind of high-end, very visual game in that experience.
It's designed to stream AAA games. That's games that are really going on, like Twitch, right?
These are games that are extremely popular, that have a really big budget behind them. These are the games that people end up playing for a very long time.
And is it going to compete with the likes of Twitch?
No, it's not. You know, Twitch is really just more of a consumption medium where you're kind of streaming games, for other people to watch. You're playing the game and then kind of broadcasting that you're playing the game for other people to watch.
Right.
This is, the game is existing somewhere else and it's being streamed to you so that you can participate. So it would be cool if Twitch were to have some kind of remote play functionality, but those aren't going to be similar services right now.
And is this going to eventually lead to a Google gaming console?
I think Google wants its gaming console to be Chromebooks, the Chrome experience. So it's possible that Google could release either an update to its Android TV platform or even a special version of the Chromecast, the Google Cast system that plugged into your television and gave you access to this game streaming service. And that would be really incredible, but it's not something that they're really doing right now.
What about Google's Project Yeti? What is that?
Project Yeti is kind of an entirely different monster, right?
Okay.
So what's being talked about here is really more about a way to stream games to a single console. And that could be, like I said, they could release a different, physical hardware device that would be just for game consoles. But this right now is just for people who have access to the Chrome browser to be able to play with devices they already own.
And you wanted to talk about Super Mario Party. Is this just like a party with Super Mario?
No, so this is cool. This is actually, weirdly, it ends up being one of my favorite games every time that it comes out. This is, I think there's 9 or 10 versions of this game so far. for a really long time. The folks at Nintendo have created this game that is a party game. It's meant to play with a whole bunch of people. And the whole premise is, what if you were playing a board game where all of the characters that you could play were characters from the Super Mario universe, and all of the games were deeply interactive? So you had to get up and move around and do stuff, and you know, and your rank on this game board, your ability to move around on this game board, you know, depended a lot on your ability to kind of be silly and play these games. And it's been a lot of fun for a while, and the latest version of this is now available for the Nintendo Switch, and it's called Super Mario Party, and it's a very similar concept, right, where you have you can play with a whole bunch of different people, either by taking the Switch with you somewhere portably or in front of your television, and it's this board game. You're playing this board game with a bunch of people who you are in the same room with. Everyone gets a part of the Nintendo Switch controller to perform these really ridiculous tasks, because they're all kind of motion-based. So it can be shaking the controller back and forth. It can be, you know, who can balance the controller on their finger the best, you know, to demonstrate balance, as, you know, and the character on the screen will kind of move to react. And you earn points as your character, the better you are at each one of these challenges, and that affects your ability to move around this game board.
A new feature is the Party Plaza. What is that?
So the Party Plaza is actually kind of a remnant of other parts of the Nintendo ecosystem. It's a way to encourage people who aren't, you know, right there in the room with you to be able to play certain versions of the game. And it's a cool way to kind of take this and make it something that can be played with more than just people that are there in the room with you. But the ultimate goal is a little different from what you would see with a strictly online game.
Then there's the mini games, which are already a part of Mario Party's culture. Are there going to be new ones?
It's certainly possible. You know, this is Nintendo hasn't done a lot of games before where they've released a bunch of updates for big games, but it's something we've seen them do over the last year. So it's definitely possible that we'll see more. You know, both more ways to play these games, you know, because a big part of the Party Plaza is just, you know, being able to pick specific games that you want to play. But it really would just depend on how Nintendo takes things into the future, which will ultimately be based on how popular this game is.
Well, how popular do you think it's going to be?
I think Mario Party games have always been tremendously popular, but they're popular in a very weird way. They don't get played every single day for hours at a time. They are... It's the game that people buy and they play once or twice, you know, with people who live in the same house with them. But then they pull it out anytime there's a group of people over. So if you're the person who has regular house parties, then this game is something that you end up paying pretty regularly. Or mm-hmm. if you're able to bring it with you to parties, then you'd be able to play it pretty regularly. But if you just don't do that kind of socializing, then this isn't a game that you're going to play a whole lot.
What about people with kids?
I have seen every single age group play and love this game. So, you know, while kids will certainly also love this game, it's really not an age-dependent game.
Okay, but everybody can play it.
Everybody can and does, in my experience.
Russell Holly, thanks as always for your help today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's Russell Holly. He's a contributing editor for Android Central. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.